A Mozillian and Rustation by Heart, Henri Sivonen got a great start. Porting Firefox Char, handling two rusts so far, it's been quietly doing its part. Henri Sivonen.
Hi, I'm Henri Sivonen. I work for Mozilla on the Gecko engine, and today I'm going to talk about a Rust crate that also quacks like a modern C++ library. So since we're at RustFest, we probably want to write Rust code, but many times there's existing C++ code that we need that Rust code to integrate with. Rust's FFI provides C APIs, and C++ community kind of frowns upon plain C, so we'll probably be better accepted if we can provide more C++-like APIs. So today I'm going to show you one weird trick for making Rust objects look like C++ objects, and then I'm going to show you rustic modern C++ types. The examples we're going to look at today come from a crate called EncodingRS, which is a character encoding conversion crate that conforms to the WatWG encoding standard, and in Firefox 56, it replaced a C++ library from 1999. It can convert to and from UTF-8, which makes sense for Rust code, including in Firefox, and it can convert to and from UTF-16, which makes sense for the pre-existing C++ code in Firefox. At Mozilla, we don't use, or we try to avoid using the C++ standard library, but today I'm going to show you C++ standard library types instead of Mozilla types, because the standard library types are probably more relevant to a larger number of you. Let's look at the REST API. There are three structs. There's a struct called encoding that represents the idea of an encoding. We have a statically allocated singleton instance for each one. So there's one for UTF-8, there's one for Windows 1252, and so forth. It provides label resolution. So when in protocol text you have charset equals foo, foo is a label, and then you can go from that kind of identifier to an instance of this struct. And it provides non-streaming conversion, which means conversion in the case where you have all the input available to the converter at one time. When you don't have the input available at one time, or you, for some other reason, want to do the conversion incrementally, then encoding acts as a factory for decoder and encoding structs, encoder structs, that encapsulate the streaming state. So here we see some code that uses this, how to obtain instances. First, we see that we refer to encoding by references that have the static lifetime because they are statically allocated singletons. If we have a variable called byte slice from protocol that contains the foo part from charset equals foo, we can pass it to encoding for a label, and then we get back an instance, or if it didn't match, then we default to Windows 1252. So we see here as an example that we can indeed refer to the encodings by named static. Then we use the encoding as a factory to create a decoder, and we see that, as is usual in Rust, the decoder is returned by value. The crate uses enum-based polymorphism. So the names encoding, decoder, and encoder sound like they could be traits, but they are indeed structs, and we'll come back later to why this is important. So for example, the struct decoder has a field variant of type variant decoder, which is an enum that wraps a struct of that implements a concrete decoder for a given encoding. The fundamental operation of the streaming API looks like this. It takes a slice of bytes as an input. It takes a caller allocated slice of output code units. So in the streaming operation, there are no heap allocations performed by EncodingRS itself. It takes a Boolean indicating whether this is the last slice to convert. And then it returns a tuple of decoder result, how many bytes were read and how many code units were written. Decoder result is a non-C-like enum because it can wrap, in the malformed case, it can wrap some information about the malformed byte sequence that we saw. In the non-streaming case, we take a slice of bytes as input, and then we tie to its lifetime a cow of stir. So if we are decoding an ASCII-compatible encoding and the input is all ASCII, then we simply borrow the input, and otherwise we have to go and allocate a string. Then we get to the C++ part. So how do we even know what is good modern C++? What should we be aiming for? We want some guidelines for using modern C++ well. And there is a document called C++ Core Guidelines that answers this question. And this isn't some random document on the internet, even though it's not an official document of the C++ Standards Committee. It's edited by Bjarne Straustrup, the creator of C++, and Herb Sutter, the convener of the C++ Standards Committee, so we'll believe that this is authoritative. And when looking at these guidelines, we see that it includes a number of rustic things. Now, I'm not saying that C++ gets those things from Rust. Rather, both languages draw from the same inspirations, but the conclusion remains that if we want to provide a modern C++ API to a Rust crate, we should be trying to recreate the Rust API using C++ types on the other side of the FFI. And this way, we'll end up with a C++ API that's more modern than the API of a typical C++ library out there. Speaking of C++ libraries, there's a library called Guidelines Support Library, which exists because the core guidelines tell you to use a couple of types that are not standardized yet, so GSL provides those. You can find it on GitHub under Microsoft's account. Let's look at the first one of the GSL types, which is GSL not null. It annotates a C++ pointer type as saying that this pointer is not null, so that's a type system annotation. It also comes with a runtime check to back that up. It doesn't change the representation of the pointer anyway, so it's a compile time thing in terms of the type, but the check is in runtime. As an example, let's look at how the static singleton instances of the encodings are declared. So in Rust, we first declare a value-typed static for each encoding, and then we declare a reference-type static that refers to the value-type static, because this is how you need to do things in Rust. On the FFI layer, we want to expose C-visible pointers to those static value types, so C-visible in the sense that their names are not mangled. And since these are pointer types, we need to new type the pointer and implement sync on the new type to keep the Rust compiler happy about the fact that we are exposing global pointers and we're saying that, yes, this is now actually okay to do across threads. Then on the C++ side, we have class encoding. We'll see in a moment what it looks like. And then we claim to C++ that these global pointers that come from the object code that the Rust compiler gave us, we claim to C++ that their type is GSL not null const pointer to the encoding class. Let's look at the encoding class. We declare it as class encoding final. So it doesn't inherit from anything, and we say final, so no other class can inherit from it either. Since all the instances came from Rust, they are statically allocated in Rust, we don't want C++ code to be able to accidentally create instances on the C++ side, so we tell C++ that we don't want the default constructor, default copy constructor, default assignment operator, or the default destructor. Then let's look at std::unique pointer, which is to C++ as box is to Rust. Now, in the Rust API, we didn't see any boxes, so why is this here? The reason is that we saw decoder returned by value, and we saw that decoder, inside of it, there's this variant decoder, which is a non-C-like enum, so decoder is a non-C-like struct, and we don't have a well-defined way to return it over the FFI by value. In theory, we could have C++ allocate some memory, provide a pointer to that memory, have Rust write through the pointer, but then we wouldn't get idiomatic ergonomics on the C++ side, so we take the cost of a heap allocation to get idiomatic ergonomics. In both cases, these are smart pointers with at most like one owner at a time with move semantics. We can declare both types in both languages. In Rust, when we want a box for foo, we call the constructor for foo, pass it to the constructor for box. In C++, since C++ 14, it's considered better practice to use a function template called makeUnique to instantiate as to the unique pointer of foo. In both languages, we can tell the smart pointer to forget about the memory that it's managing and give us the raw pointer to the memory. Then in both languages, we can put a smart pointer back together from a raw pointer. Let's look at a concrete example. So on the encoding struct, we had a factory method called new decoder that takes self by reference and returns a decoder by value. Then on the FFI layer, we since we are wrapping a method of a struct called encoding, we prefix the name of the function with the name of the struct. So we call the function encoding new decoder. We take what becomes the self-reference in the case of calling the method as a pointer, so we get a pointer to an encoding as an argument. We return a mute pointer to a decoder, so we call a new decoder on the object that's pointed to by the pointer, pass it to the constructor of box, and then immediately tell box to forget about what it just did. Since we told box to forget about what it just did, we need something else to be able to free this allocation later. So we declare a function called decoder free that takes a pointer to a decoder, puts a box back together for it, assigns it to a variable, the variable goes out of scope, and then the memory gets freed. On the C++ side, in Rust, we had a method called new decoder. We declare a method called new decoder that returns a std unique pointer of decoder, and we say that it's const because it doesn't modify the encoding itself, so that this pointer is a typed const pointer. We pass this pointer to the FFI function that we created, and then we construct a std unique pointer around the raw pointer that we get back. On the deletion side, it's more involved. On the decoder object, we have an empty destructor because we don't want that to do anything, and we overload operator delete that takes a void pointer to decoder for reasons, but it's guaranteed to be reinterpretable as a pointer to a decoder, so we do that, and we pass the pointer to the decoder free FFI function, and this way, when std unique pointer goes out of scope, it deletes its pointer to decoder, it runs the destructor that does nothing, and then we route the pointer back to Rust for the memory to be freed with the right allocator. And as with encoding, we tell C++ that we don't want instances of these to be able to be created on the C++ side. Now, how is that possible? We had some pointers from Rust, then we just claimed to C++ that these are some pointers to C++ class types, and then we passed this pointer back to Rust. So what's going on here? To see what a method call in even means, let's look at method calls in Rust. So if we have a struct foo and it has a method getVal, and then we have an instance of foo called bar, and we call bar.getval. It's just syntactic sugar for foo colon colon getval, and passing a reference to bar as an explicit first argument. And that sort of explains why it's declared in a way that self is a first argument. So that's all there is to it. And on the C++ side, it's the same story, except this has the role of reference to self in Rust. In C++, we don't write this pointer explicitly in the argument list, but we do write the constness of this after the argument list if we want it to be a const pointer type. The important thing here is that there are no B tables. So in Rust, a trait type pointer is two pointers. One pointer to the object instance and another pointer to an array of function pointers for operating on that instance. And since we want these pointers to travel back and forth between the languages, since C++ uses a plane pointer to point to objects, we can't have the other pointer from the dual pointer from Rust travel over because we don't have place for the other half. So that's why we can't have Rust trait objects. On the other hand, C++ needs another place for its vtable pointer because the pointers to objects are plane pointers, so it puts its vtable pointer on the objects themselves. So when you have inheritance in C++, C++ goes ahead and dereferences this pointer to find a vtable pointer. And since this is actually pointing to a Rust object, there is no C++ vtable pointer there, and we can't have C++ dereferencing this pointer, so we just can't have any inheritance on the C++ side, which means that we can't inherit from some kind of common superclass of a C++ framework. In Gecko, we don't get to inherit from NSI supports. If we were in a Qt app, we wouldn't be able to inherit from Q objects, for example. Then let's take a look at these more of these rustic C++ types. There's Studio Optional, which is like option in Rust. In Rust, we can return none. In C++, we can return Studio Null Opt. In Rust, we can return some foo. In C++, we just return foo, and some implicit stuff happens. We can ask if an option or Studio Optional wraps a value. We can get that value, or we can get that value, or if it doesn't wrap a value, take some default. So it looks like it's just the same thing. There is one thing to be aware of, though, which is that the most ergonomic way to extract a value from a Studio Optional is operator star, which is unchecked and therefore unsafe. So watch out for that. In Rust, we often like to return multiple values as tuples. And in C++, we have Studio Tuple. In both languages, we can declare methods that return a tuple of some types. In both languages, we can take some values and return them as a tuple. And in both languages, we can take a returned tuple and destructure it into a bunch of variables. As is usual with Rust, if we want mutability in Rust, we say mute. And if we don't want mutability in C++, we say const. Again, the same thing. GSL span provides the slice concept for C++. A slice is a pointer and a length, a const pointer in the case of a read-only span. So in C++, GSL span puts these together. And in the case of a read-only span, the const specifier goes inside the type parameter of GSL span. We can use GSL make span to take a span view to a contiguous container. And then we can use a two-argument version of GSL span to put a span together from a pointer and a length. We can access spans like we do slices in Rust. We can iterate over them. We can index into them. And indexing is a checked operation even in C++, so it's safe. And we can take the pointer and length back apart. Again, there's some tiny thing to be aware of, which is that taking a subspan is slightly less ergonomic for common cases than in Rust, because the subspan function takes the start index and the length of the subspan. So you have to compute the length yourself in case you're sort of assuming the Rust thing of being able to pass the index to the next item not included. Since we have our own versions of all of these in Mozilla code, we get to fix design bugs like that. You should be aware that in C++, read-only string slices are a special case called studio string view, or in the UTF-16 case, studio U16 string view, that are already in the standard library, unlike span, which you need to get from GSL. This kind of makes sense, like superficial sense from a Rust perspective, since Rust has separate string slices. But in Rust, those provide UTF-8 validity. These don't, so they aren't that useful compared to GSL span. It's more a matter of the committee being able to agree to these first. But if you use the C++ standard library, you should just be using these and not go against the way of the land. A key difference, though, between slices and spans is that spans, a zero-length span can contain a null pointer. A slice can never contain a null pointer, because Rust has an optimization that an option of slice takes the same space as a slice, and to distinguish some wrapping a zero-length span from none, we need some non-zero bits in the pointer to act as the discriminant. So when you have some pointers that you take from a span and you want to create a slice with them, you have to have something along the way that replaces all null pointers with bogus pointers. And then let's look at a concrete example that puts all these together. On the encoding struct, we have a static method called forBOM that takes a byte, a slice of bytes, checks if it starts with a byte order mark. If it doesn't, returns none. If it does, returns a tuple of the encoding and the length of the byte order mark. On the FFI layer, we have a bunch of stuff going on here. Again, we have the same naming convention as before, but since it's a static method, we don't take a pointer that would correspond to the self-reference or this pointer. We just take the slice decomposed into pointer and length. Since we have two values to return, the encoding and the length of the BOM, we only get one return value from C, so we use that for a pointer to encoding, and then we need an outparam for the length of the BOM. Since the length of the BOM is kind of logically related to the incoming slice, instead of introducing an extra outparam, we reuse the incoming length as an inoutparam, so it's a mute pointer to use size instead of use size. In the case the Rust method returns none, we return a null pointer and zero length. And then on the C++ side, we reverse the whole thing. And now we get to recreate the Rust API on C++ side. So on class encoding, we have a static method called forBOM that returns a studio optional containing a studio tuple containing GSL not null of const pointer to encoding and a size t, and as an argument takes a GSL span of const u int 8t. And then we need to create a stack variable for use its address as an inout param. When we take the pointer from the slice, we pass it to null to bogus in order to make it okay to use as a pointer to a slice. If we get back a non-null encoding, we create a studio tuple, and here we need to do it explicitly because we have a tuple inside an option, so the brace syntax would make the inference fall over. We have to tell it first that this is a tuple, and then the optional gets created implicitly, and if we got a null pointer, we return a studio null opt. In the streaming API, though, we saw that we had a non-C-like enum in the Rust API. So can we do the same thing with it? C++ does have a type-safe discriminated union type called studio variant, but unfortunately, it's not really enum. The variants are not named. It was proposed as L variant, but not accepted. It's legal to declare duplicate types, but if you do, things become really impractical, so not in practice. But most importantly, there's no language level analog for match, One was proposed as inspect, but again, not accepted. So instead, I just ended up manually packing the bits into a U32 and using that both in the C API and in the C++ API, since most of the time, the information wrapped in the malformed case isn't going to be looked at by most applications. It's just specialized applications that actually want to look at that. What about the cows, though? In the non-streaming API, we saw that encoding RS was returning cows of str. And even the cow part isn't the problem. Just the string or vec is a problem because C doesn't have universally accepted standard library way of representing a growable buffer that knows its length. But since the non-streaming API is just convenience functionality on top of the streaming API, I just didn't expose the non-streaming API to C at all, and instead recreated that functionality on top of the streaming functionality on the C++ side. So in C++, we could, in principle, declare a studio variant of studio string and studio string view, and that would be like structurally the same thing as a cow. But in C++, we don't have a borrow checker, so we can't represent the lifetime of studio string view, which makes this sort of thing very unsafe in C++. So if we return a studio string view or a GSL span, there is no compiler mechanism making sure that the memory that it points to lives for as long, at least as long enough as long as the string view or span. So instead, I decided to keep it simple for the standard library binding and just return a studio string in this case. In the Gecko case, XPCOM strings have or can have heap allocated shared buffers. So in that case, a borrow just becomes a reference count increment. So borrow was possible in a safe way in the Gecko case. In fairness, let's look at what we didn't see today. So it seemed like, okay, we had these things, and they nicely translated to C++, except for the enum instead of variant thing. And this looked nice. In fairness, what was not here in this example? We didn't see Rust code examining any non-primitive C++ types. It's totally doable, but we didn't see it today. We didn't see Rust code holding pointers to C++ objects. Again, doable, but increases complexity. And we didn't see Rust code calling out to FFI. And again, it's doable, but if you do, watch out for the C++ code that you call into freeing the arguments that you got from C++. It's a normal C++ concern, but when you're writing Rust code, you might not be thinking of it in terms of your arguments disappearing while you are in a function. So let's recap what we saw. We saw that this pointer in C++ is just like a reference to self, and those are just syntactic sugar in the non-inherited, non-trait case. So we can't have a C++ inheritance. We can't have Rust trait objects going over the boundary. However, we can declare C++ visible Rust statics. We saw how GSL not null can be used to make C++ pointers more like Rust references. We learned about studio unique pointer, which is to C++ as box is to Rust. We saw how to tell C++ that we don't want some default constructors generated so that we don't accidentally instantiate the reflector classes from C++. We saw how we can use overloading of operator delete to route the deletion of a heap allocated Rust object that pretends to be a C++ object back to Rust when it's time to release it. We saw that C++ now has studio optional, that is just like option in Rust that we use a lot. We saw that we can return multiple values in both languages. We saw that there is the slice concept in C++, and there's a special case for read-only string slices, and we saw that discriminated type-safe unions exist, but they are kind of inconvenient to use. And then we saw that the C++ type system is able to represent the structure of cows, but not their lifetimes, which makes cows dangerous in C++. So we shouldn't just do all the things we do in Rust in C++, but like this thing becomes dangerous, so let's not do that one. And that's it. You can find the slides at that address. Thanks.